Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
Right, the Rugby World Cup is done for 2023, and for us here in South Africa, we have lots to celebrate as the Springboks edged out New Zealand by 1 point in the final. That was the third match in a row that the Springboks won by 1 point, and I can tell you that the collective nation of South Africa is probably a couple of years older than they would have been at the beginning of this last 3 weeks, purely because of the stress of those last few games. And for those of us in South Africa, and for those of you listening overseas, I can tell you that the significance of that win was probably more than what you saw just on the sporting front. It really does have the ability to unite a nation, and in South Africa, it really was uniting force. Every part of South Africa celebrated the win of the Springboks. There were scenes all over the country of people dancing in the streets and that sort of thing. So, you know, the power of a game is a simple sport like rugby that can change the way the nation feels about itself, I think is significant. And I think that we can't underestimate the power of sport. And sometimes we underestimate that to some extent. I know I do. I think, well, it's just sport. It doesn't really matter to my life whether or not the Springboks win the World Cup or not. But when you go into the streets and you see people wearing Springbok jerseys and wearing their caps and flying their flags and that sort of thing, I think it really does have a uniting benefit for the entire nation. And not surprisingly, the president of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, was there at the final, raising the cup at one point, taking advantage of the situation to some extent, as he has been ridiculed on social media. But Ross, you were there. And you were there, in fact, for the last three games of the box. It must have been a fantastic experience just to be part of that and to see that all happening in front of you.
Yeah, it was amazing. Only sport can do that. Mm. I don't think there's anything else that can create that sense of unity and division. Like, it's not always unity. It's also division. But we're on the lucky side of it now that it's unifying. And it was amazing. It was unbelievable. The last 3 weeks must be the best 3 weeks in South African sporting history because of the way in which it was done, you know. Obviously, 1995 had political implications that probably go bigger than this. Mm. But in terms of like sheer on-field sports performance, this is as good as I can remember anything in South African sport being. And I've been actually quite disappointed that I couldn't come home straight away. I'm in London now. I thought I'd have a little bit to do after the World Cup, so I stayed on for a week, and I've missed a lot of the celebrations. So I've been limited to seeing it on social media, you know, the arrival of the team back at the airports. Mm. They had a big presentation day, and it seems completely immersive. It looks to me like the same atmosphere as when we hosted the Football World Cup in 2010.
Yeah.
I remember back then I was invited up by the BBC to come to Soweto and join a panel discussion on sport. I don't know why I was asked to. They probably ran out of other people. But I remember going up there and renting a car, and there was a traffic jam on the highway getting to Soweto, and it was stuck. And normally that would be massive tensions. People would be angry and irritable, but no one cared. Everyone was just happy. And it was a completely different. And then I actually got rear-ended by someone who wasn't paying attention, and he hit the back of my car. Luckily, not bad enough to do damage, but we both got out. Now, that's in South Africa, that's a potential life-changing incident normally.
Normally fisticuffs.
Yeah, exactly. But we looked at each other. We looked at the cars. We saw neither of us had damage. He gave me a massive hug. He said, enjoy the World Cup. And off we went. It was completely different. It was like unlike anything you'd find in South Africa. And it seems to me that this rugby victory is given at the same atmosphere. You're there, so you'd know more than I'm looking at it as an outsider, actually.
Yeah, I mean, here in Cape Town today, as we record this, they're doing the trophy tour in Cape Town. And anybody that I've spoken to on social media saying, what are you up to today? They're saying, well, we're going to watch the trophy tour. So there's a huge amount of interest. And there's no doubt that in Cape Town Central today, there's going to be thousands of people in the streets welcoming the players. And we saw some amazingly emotive videos. One of the ones that really touched me was the image of the video of Rassie Erasmus as he arrives back at the Johannesburg airport, OR Tambo. And you can see the tears in his eyes and the emotion on his face as he sees the crowd waiting for the players to come through, and Siya Kolisi raising the cup in dramatic fashion in front of thousands of people at the airport. It was really, I mean, I get goosebumps actually sitting here, and I can feel it, the excitement and the patriotism that comes from that. So yes, the impact has been huge.
I mean, I saw that video, and I saw there was another one of him at the same time when they were then handing the trophy around, and Jesse Creel, our centre, goes up to him, tries to give him the trophy, and he says, no, send it to other players. Did you see that one?
No, didn't see that one.
So he says, no, I don't want to hold the trophy. Send it to the other players. Now, you compare that to Cyril Ramaphosa coming on the stadium, and within 8 seconds of Kolisi getting the trophy, Ramaphosa had his hands on it.
So the reason that's politics for you.
Exactly. The reason I bring that up is because every time Kolisi talks about what it means and so on, and you know what's interesting is that our guys speak about it before it happens, not after the fact. A lot of the time in sport, you get hindsight reporting where people say afterwards how unified everything was. These guys were telling us that before. So I think it's quite meaningful in that respect. But what foreigners outside South Africa might not realize is that this Springbok team is one of the few things South Africans actually have that they can point to: excellence, leadership, elite performance, proper high performance. And I think that's part of why it means so much, you know, because we have this model in this team for like what good leadership and what good unity and diversity and so on look like. And I mean, it's funny even for me to hear myself say that. It sounds cheesy normally, but they legitimately are what Kolisi says they are, which is the last resort against South Africa's erosion in the global stage. So it means far more than rugby does. And I mean, it was just unbelievable in Paris for the last 3 weeks. If you'd said you're going to win all three knockout matches by a total of 3 points, and that the guy who comes in to kick those points is not going to miss one single kick in all the games that he plays, not one missed kick.
Yeah, Andre Pollard was 100% record, wasn't he?
It's astonishing. Like, it's just unbelievable. And you know what the most flattering and encouraging thing for me is? I remember the days that South African rugby was thuggish, boorish, unintellectual, big guy smashing opponents. Do you remember those days?
Yeah.
Like, nowadays, I listen to podcasts and so on from, let's be honest, a little bit disgruntled Northern Hemisphere journalists, podcasters and so on. And they talk about the mad scientist, Rassie Erasmus and Jacques Nienaber. They talk about the intellectual approach and the experimentation and the innovation of South African rugby. I love it when you hear that sort of stuff, because our personality on the global stage has changed. And we're now the innovative team that comes with new ideas and pushes boundaries, sometimes maybe to a fault, but it's just amazing. Every single, what looked like a risk that coaching team took over the last 2 or 3 years paid off. And there's no other team that could have won that tournament along the path that we did. Because if we hadn't had the depth, if we hadn't had the player management, if we hadn't had the tactical approach, if we hadn't had the forwards back split on the bench, if we hadn't had the complementary skills, we hadn't had the leadership on the field, even when the captain goes off, the guys left behind are still leaders, we wouldn't have been able to win that. And so it was like, it was the perfect illustration of designing success.
I mean, let's face it, and I'd like to hear your views on this, because in the semi-final, and to some extent in the final, there was a certain element of luck, because the teams they were competing against missed a lot of opportunities. As we'll get on to now, there were some controversial decisions in both those games, and particularly in the final. And yes, as much as you say all of that, it could easily have gone either way in both the semi and the final. So there's always that aspect in sport where you can say teams are fairly lining up at that final in a fairly equal level. In fact, if I chose between New Zealand and South Africa in the final, it was as much as a draw as it could possibly be, except for that 1 point. So did we deserve it, or did we just get a bit of luck going our way for a change.
No, of course we deserve. Like, you could argue the luck in the other direction as well. You could say on another day we would have won by 20 points.
Yeah.
You know, like, maybe it was lucky for them, it was close. So, I'm not saying that to be provocative. I'm saying that because remember, in that game, within 90 seconds, we lost our hooker, the only hooker we had.
Yeah.
And for 78 and a half minutes, we played with a flanker at hooker. It neutralized our scrum. Our lineout was under pressure the whole game long. In the end, somehow they pulled it off. I mean, that was heroic by Dion Fourie. And you can always point, it's true, you can always point to things. And I think rugby's actually got a major problem with this. If you look at the reaction out of France when they lost to us, when you look at the reaction out of England when they lost to us, when you look at our reaction when we lost to the British and Irish Lions 2 years ago, there have been other instances as well, like we're by no means exempt from this. Rugby's got a problem with fans who are quick to blame and who don't take things on to themselves. So I think that does play into it a little bit. But I don't think it's luck when you can do it consistently. You know, that, like, yeah, there's always a little bit of luck, but there's a little bit of bad luck also. And I don't know, playing those sort of post-mortems and saying, oh, you were lucky here and there, of course you can do that. But you can also say you were unlucky here or there.
Yeah.
They were lucky here or there. They were also unlucky here or there. And obviously the red card changed it, and I wish it hadn't ever happened, because you don't want there to be an asterisk in anyone's mind next to a World Cup win. You want to be able to say, we won this thing clean.
Yeah.
And so the moment that red card happened, I was like, oh, man, that's a blemish on the final.
Mm.
It's not that it's the wrong decision, in my opinion. I think it's correct and it's necessary. Mm. They are avoidable. But unfortunately, it does leave that. But if it weren't for,
yeah,
I hate the fact that there's always going to be those open doors. I'd rather win the game convincingly and shut off all conversation, but that's what happened. So,
just before you get into the red cards, and I do want to get into this a little bit because it is interesting, those potential two incidents around Khaleesi and Sam Kane. Just being overseas, looking at some of the media, obviously here in South Africa, we are seeing just massive celebrations and hype. What was the reaction, for instance, in the UK around the Springboks win? Is it a celebration of excellence? What was the general tone of that coverage, you think?
Well, I think you must be careful, I suppose, always about general tone, because then you're going to lump some people in with others and they don't deserve it.
Mm.
Because some of the coverage has been really good. Like, I saw a video on Twitter the other day by Bernard Jackman, who's a pundit, former coach from Ireland, and he did an analysis of our defensive decision-making patterns, execution. Outstanding, incredibly complimentary. There have been other guys, and I tweeted actually the other day, guys like Sam Lana, who've done really good analysis all tournament and before, and they'll keep doing it. Well worth a follow if you follow rugby. And they understand exactly what it is that we do, how we play to our strengths, the innovations and so on. And they're very complimentary. They say an amazing final. They say incredible performance from the All Blacks to compensate for that player down. They'll talk about the Springbok tactics, playing to the strength and so on, like all the things we've just mentioned. But then at the same time, you've got journalists, often in the mainstream media, who just cannot get out of rugby's way. And, you know, the more I read, like, the stuff that comes out of the mainstream media, the more I think rugby loves to portray itself as a sport in crisis. It loves to talk about sport that will never appeal to the casual fan. There's an Irish podcast show called Off the Ball, in which they said the Springboks are world champions, but friendless. So, oh, no friends. The Stephen Jones, who's a journalist from the Times, wrote something about one of the ugliest rugby matches ever played, and the Springboks. I forget some of the words that he used. I didn't. I sort of maybe blocked it out. It was such garbage. And I think that one of the things that rugby can do, if it really wants to grow, is to try and give the people who actually like the game a better voice. Because sometimes it feels to me that some of the people who cover the sport don't even like it. It's weird.
Yeah.
You know, like that. It's just the whining and the complaining and the fault finding and the negativity, the cynicism. It's just whinging and nonstop. Like, it's unbelievable. But then when you look at the young guys who do the analysis and you actually understand how the sport has moved on from the 1990s, they see the value in the diversity of the game, the way that it's played in different styles, the difference in approach from New Zealand compared to South Africa, the tactical and strategic contrasts. That's where things are great. I mean, so many amazing things in that final happened. You know, you had a flanker packing down for South Africa in the front row. New Zealand had a flanker in the scrum because they lost theirs to the red card. Amazing. No one even discussed it because they were too busy whinging about the red card and the sport in crisis. It's crazy. Like, if there was a quarterfinal, semifinal, final weekend, like the Rugby World Cup produced every single week, are you genuinely telling me that people wouldn't love to watch rugby?
Yeah. It was great viewing, I agree.
Exactly. That quarterfinal weekend, on the Monday after those quarterfinals, everyone said, this is the peak of rugby. Rugby has never been better. Within 1 week, rugby was dead. It's unbelievable. Like, you know, like, and then when we beat England, thanks in large part to the pressure that we started to apply on the scrums in the last half an hour of that match, thanks to our front row substitutes, then the media in England were saying that this is not the way that rugby should be won, thanks to scrums. Rugby's got a problem with scrums. 1 week before that, no one mentioned them. After the final, nobody mentioned it. Mm-hmm. By the time the final came around, it was all about the kicking and the Springboks' anti-rugby tactics. The one New Zealand journalist wrote something about the Springboks won the World Cup not by playing the best team at not playing rugby was the world champion. That was the view. So, like, a couple of things on that is, with my biased supporter hat on, I think it's great when people talk like that because it means that they haven't recognized the problem. And if they're blaming everything but themselves, they're never going to bridge the gap. So you'll keep losing. Until you can actually start understanding why you lost, you'll never figure out how to win. So that's one good thing. But it's also just, I don't know, sometimes it feels like the media, when you were in high school biology, did you learn about amoebas?
Very well. I know a lot about amoebas.
And one of the things about amoebas that I remember learning about was that they've got this like excessive tactile response that if you poke them with something, then they retract. And they,
single cell organisms.
All they do is they just react to like environmental stimuli. And I sometimes feel like most of the rugby media are amoebas because all they can ever do is to react to the thing that's just happened this weekend. There seems to be no understanding of the bigger picture and the nuance and so on. And it's only the young guys on Twitter who, thanks to social media, have a voice. And if I could change one thing, I would give those guys the mainstream media platforms, and rugby would be far healthier than it is now with some of the people in there. Not all. Charlie Morgan at the Telegraph, great stuff. Murray Kinsella with Irish media, amazing. But man, there are some toxic characters in the sport.
Yeah, don't forget, I mean, I'm putting my media hat on here, that obviously mainstream media is under some pressure to create clicks and likes and viewership and readership and all that sort of thing. So you have to create a story, and sometimes the best way to create a story is to be controversial around it. So your headline that grabs attention is going to be something that people are going to click on. And sometimes just saying it like it is isn't that exciting. And I think there is that pressure on mainstream media to find that angle, that clickable headline, that bait, the clickbait that you want to get, because most of the mainstream media now is online, and they're competing against those social media guys that you talk about, and they're competing for eyeballs and relevance and credibility, all those things. So there is that subtle pressure for sure in traditional media to be competitive.
It's true. It's just sad though. Like, I mean, so I reckon you probably find, in the 48 hours after that final, there was more said about Wayne Barnes, the referee, than there was said about some of the great player performances on both sides of the ball. You know, like, New Zealand had some unbelievable performances. Talia, Barrett, Sevilla, obviously, as usual. Unbelievable. But, like, they were neglected by many people covering it because they were more obsessed about talking about how Wayne Barnes wanted to make himself the center of attention. And again, that's not unique to them. It was the same thing we saw the week before from English fans. It was the same thing we saw from the French. It was the same thing we saw from our fans in the British and Irish Lions, and have seen before that. So it's a universal characteristic. But I just think it's sad because there's so much more value that you can extract from a game, especially games at that standard and that level. But instead, all we're talking about is Wayne Barnes, who actually was very good. So.
And sadly, I mean, the commentators even here in South Africa were commenting on this, that every time there was a referee's decision because of the game that France lost to South Africa, there was this sort of booing of every single time an official made a call that the French crowd would boo, and it almost became part of it, so that the referees were being ridiculed at every moment. And here in South Africa, the commentators are saying it's becoming a bit ridiculous now that the referee is becoming the focus of every decision, is questioned and booed. So yes, there was a lack of focus on the best performances. Let's just talk.
I don't know what you do about that. So I was just going to say the one thing is Wayne Barnes subsequently retired, right? And I think it was always his intention to retire. So it was really cool that he got to do that final match and then retire with that as his last game. But in his retiring statement, he didn't make mention of the fact that the abuse had gotten excessive. Now, I don't think that's the reason he's retired, but it's definitely something. And, you know, a couple of years ago, he was influential in setting up basically what's a union for referees now. And one of the primary drivers of that was the abuse they were getting. And that abuse was actually at the hands of our fans. There were death threats made to Barnes, consequence of a game that we lost, and the fans blamed him for it. So I'm not trying to sit here and say, like, we're the saints of this rugby supporting world, because we're just as guilty as everyone else. But like it was amazing. Like, you know, Ben O'Keefe was the New Zealander who did our quarterfinal against France. He then did the semi. He came out the tunnel for the warm-up, and you should have heard the booing. Unbelievable. Wow. Like, just unpleasant, you know? So I don't know how rugby gets a grip on that, but I think it does need to do so, because it's occupying far too much of the column inches and attention and energy. And it's not, it's clearly not good for the game.
Yeah. Let's just touch very briefly on, I'd just like your views on this, because obviously there were two particular incidences that were controversial in relevance to this. First of all, Sam Kane initially getting a yellow card for a high tackle and then being sent off. And then that was reviewed and he gets a red card. And then Sekulise, in a similar sort of incident, gets yellow carded, not upgraded to red card. Just your views on that, were they the right decisions? I know that you've been very involved in the lawmaking around this with your role at World Rugby. So just like your thoughts on whether you saw those in differently to where they compared to what the referees saw them.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things on that. First of all, I think both were correct. I didn't see them at the time. You know, when you're in a stadium, you're trying to look at the screen, they show one replay, it's difficult. But I've looked at them a lot since, and I do see why both were made, and I think I agree with them. Both are made by the bunker system, and I don't think we've really had a chance to talk about the bunker that was adopted for this World Cup. The premise of the bunker, and I think it actually, this is where you see it working as well as it can possibly work, is in a World Cup final.
So just explain what the bunker is for those that don't know what you mean by the bunker.
So its official name is Foul Play Review Officer. And so what you would know, and listeners would know, that the sport has struggled for a few years now with trying to understand how to sanction dangerous tackles. So we're talking here about foul play tackles that need to be given either a yellow or a red card. And since 2017, there's been quite a lot of inconsistency and variability around the world about how these cards are given. In one competition, you'll see an increase, and another one, you'll see a decrease. You think, geez, we need to get some alignment and some consistency here. So how do we solve this problem of two different assessors looking at something differently? And it's a calibration exercise, right? And so a lot of time and effort has been put into that. And one of the things that was proposed towards the back end of last year is that it's really difficult for the guy on the field, studs in the grass, to have to stop the game, look up at the big screen, talking to a TMO, try and get a good angle of a replay of a high tackle incident, run through that process while surrounded in this cauldron of noise, 65,000-70,000 people screaming, there's pressure on the guy. And so some people suggested to World Rugby that maybe this is the kind of thing that should be taken offline into a review process that happens off field. And so that changes the dynamic now, because now the referee on the field never has to run through the detailed process. All he's got to do is make the assessment, does this meet a minimum standard of a yellow card? Because you'll know that when the guy gets a yellow card, he's going off for 10 minutes. So in effect, you buy time for the decision to be made, right? Why make it in 2 minutes when you could make it in 10? And so the change that was then made, and it was done initially in Super Rugby, is that when the referee sees foul play that's worthy of at least a yellow card, the only decision that ref has to make is to give that yellow card and refer the rest to someone else. And that someone else is a foul play review officer who sits in a room away from the stadium, away from the pressure, who's got a direct line to the TV directors, who can request multiple angles, who can work with a Hawkeye consultant to slow it down, speed it up, watch it in normal speed, watch it at slow motion speed, run through the process very systematically and deliberately and slowly. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
The thinking was that if you did that, you would alleviate some of the pressure on the guy on the field. You'd give someone more time, more space, more breathing room to make a good decision that would be better for the game. And so that was done in that final. And I think it's good because Wayne Barnes does not want to give that red card. That's the reality.
Mm.
You don't want to be the guy in the 27th minute of a World Cup final to have to then, for 5 minutes, think about, am I going to do this, given all the implications of giving this red card? So what you do for Wayne Barnes is you say, all you've got to do, Wayne, is you've got to recognize whether it's minimum yellow. That's easy to do. And then you must go off for the review. And then from that point, someone else takes over. And I think it's right. I think it's good that it's done that way, because it means that you can make a team decision and you can alleviate some of the responsibility on the guy on the field. I don't think people have understood that very well. And there was a lot of complaining about why some refs don't just give the red card on the field. Well, no, you've told them that they don't need to, so therefore they're not going to.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's where it comes into play. So he gives the yellow card to both Khaleesi and Kane. And then what's happening is that that bunker official who actually was sitting at Roland Garros, at the tennis facility, that's where the media center was, is looking at those replays and asking the key questions. Now, remember that the head contact process is, was there head contact? Yes. Was the foul play? Yes. What was the degree of danger? Those are the three things that the on-field referee is assessing. And so Wayne Barnes has done that for Kane and Khaleesi. And he said, yes, yes, and danger is high. Therefore, yellow card minimum. Basically, all that the off-field official has to then do is he has to confirm whether, in fact, the degree of danger is high or not. And then he has to look to see what the degree of mitigation might be. And if he can find mitigation, then he can keep it at yellow. And if he can't find mitigation, then the red card decision probably stays. And that's exactly what happened with Kane. So that decision would have been assessed as high in danger and without mitigation, red card. The Khaleesi decision would have been assessed as high in danger with mitigation in that specific instance, because Khaleesi was actually the second tackler. Dwayne Vermeulen hit Sevilla just before Khaleesi. And as a consequence of Vermeulen, Ardie Sevilla's head drops in height and he moves to his right. And that's what causes the head-on-head contact from Khaleesi. It's interesting. If you pause or freeze frame those tackles at the moment of contact, Khaleesi is quite significantly bent. And the contact is actually happening on Ardie Sevilla's upper arm. And so it's not a high tackle per se. What happens is that there's head-on-head contact as he follows through with the tackle. And so they've decided that it's mostly to the body with secondary head contact and also that there's mitigation. And that's why they changed it to a yellow card. And you can see the rationale for that. When it comes to the Kane one, I suppose one could try and make an argument that it's not high in danger because it's not super high speed. If you watch the replay, I think you can make the case that he is moving forward into that contact and there is movement of his arm in what's an attempted dominant tackle. So I would argue that it is high in danger and there's no mitigation because he's upright and the ball carrier hasn't changed his height or level down at all at any time. So, yeah, I mean, it was a moment. The moment it happened, I was getting messages from people saying that's going to be a bad one. And you just get the sinking feeling because no one wants it, right? No one wants there to be a red card in a World Cup final.
Yeah,
but that's not reason not to give it. You can't say, "Oh, this is red because it's a normal match." Oh no, wait, today it's yellow because it's a final. No, it's not. That's not how it works.
And so the difference the difference is mitigation as opposed to intent, because I'm always interested to know. So intent. Somebody intends to go high. I guess that could be argued in many different respects. Actually, the differentiator is mitigation.
There's two differentiators. It's degree of, so remember, there are four decisions: head contact, yes or no; foul play, yes or no. Third question: degree of danger, high or low. That's the first differentiator, because if it's high, it starts at red. If it's low, then it starts at yellow, low or medium. And then the fourth question is mitigation. So there's two points at which you can arrive at a different decision. So high right. danger, no mitigation equals red. High danger, yes mitigation equals yellow. Or low danger, no mitigation equals yellow. Low danger with mitigation equals penalty. So you can arrive at three different outcomes depending on how you put those yes, no answers together. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so yeah, like, and that has to be subjective. You know, when we first launched in 2019, the high tackle sanction framework, one of the big criticisms was that it was too rigid and didn't give the referees enough subjectivity. And so the change that was made in the head contact process is to try and allow for more interpretation, more subjectivity. I'm not sure I entirely agree with that. I think that you should try and, if you want consistency, you want to try and eliminate gray. But that's what they wanted. So therefore, that's what we've got, is these two decisions around danger and mitigation that are going to be subjective. But when we said, okay, how do we know something's high in danger? Well, because it's high speed, swinging arm, the player follows through. It's a dominant tackle as opposed to a passive or a soak tackle. There's certain video signs that reveal whether something is higher or lower in danger. And I'm actually just busy writing up an analysis right now. I have 150 odd head injuries. And the risk of a head injury when there is a red card is 250 times higher than when there's no red card. It is like, and I'm not exaggerating scale. When a tackle is red carded, the risk of an HIA is 250 times higher than when the tackle is legal. So what's a red card? It's a head contact tackle caused by a foul player that is high in danger without mitigation. So what we're saying is that if you see head contact, foul play, high danger, no mitigation, you are 250 times more likely to see a head injury than when there's not, than when there's a legal tackle. So what does that mean?
Explains why the rule is in place.
Exactly.
Fairly obviously. Exactly. Yeah.
And a red card is three times more likely to cause a head injury than a yellow card.
Yeah.
And a yellow card is 80 times more likely than no card. So I think that's important information to keep in mind. But again, it sucks that it happened in the final.
Yeah.
It really does. Like it's for Kane, for the sake of the occasion, for the sport, it sucks. But that's not a reason to change things.
Yeah.
And I mean, absolutely. Again, I think I've told the story is Jacques Nienaber was the defense coach of South Africa when that high tackle sanction framework was introduced. And he has literally said to me, his initial reaction was, this is shit. This is going to take away a South African strength. We don't want this.
Mm.
But you see, the thing is, those guys, they're so intelligent and they're so strategic, and I think they're emotionally intelligent as well. We realized very quickly that this is what's happening, and it's necessary for the sake of head injuries and for players' health. And Jacques then recognized that he could coach according to that decision-making process. And so he literally has said that he went away and he looked at the high tackle sanction framework and he's looked at the head contact process and he said to his players, we're going to teach you to tackle according to these processes so that you don't get red cards. That's why Khaleesi was bent. That's why Etzebeth was bent the week before, 2 weeks before. That's why Peter Steph de Toy could make 28 tackles and not one of them was even close to being a red card tackle.
Yeah, one of the performances of the final.
Ireland made 700 and something tackles in this World Cup and South Africa made over 1,000. Not one of them was red carded.
Wow.
It's not accident. Okay, there were a couple of yellow cards in there, but they were mitigated because the player is bent and you're in a sense protecting yourself by putting yourself in a mitigated position through your own actions. You know what I mean? Like that's the point I'm trying to make here is that, so I'm sympathetic, but I'm also of the mind that you can, maybe not all of them, but you can deal with a lot of these. It's controllable.
Yeah. And South Africa, who are probably the team most unlikely to adapt, actually have adapted.
Well, again, you see, that's unlikely to adapt. That's the old South African rugby.
Yeah.
The new South African rugby is innovators and smart guys. And that's what I love most about the fact that we won it like we did, you know?
Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff. And for those of you who've been following our podcast over the last couple of months, I know we've been talking a lot about rugby, and it has been a fascinating time for all of us. I'm sure that even if you weren't a rugby fan, maybe you've got involved in the Rugby World Cup more than you would have done previously. So thank you to all of the comments that we've received about rugby. It has certainly been very vociferous conversations on our Patreon channels and on our other social media channels. So thank you very much for that. And again, lovely stuff to watch.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Anyway, as Monty Python once said, now it's time for something completely different. And this subject is something that I find quite fascinating. And it was kind of facilitated by an article that I saw on Outside Online. And I can tell you that some of the stuff on Outside Online is absolutely brilliant. Their journalism is of the highest order, and I've got a huge amount of respect for everything that they do on Outside Online. They have a section on that website called Velo, which is all about cycling. And there was a story written in just the end of October by Jim Cotton, and it's got a headline which says, "A massive change, how a carbohydrate revolution is speeding up pro cycling." Now, to give you a brief summary of what this article says, it talks about the fact that what we've seen, particularly in cycling over the last year or 2 years, is the fact that professional riders are able to ingest and use more carbohydrate than ever before. In fact, he talks about the fact that in the last 2 decades, that has almost doubled the amount of carbohydrate than we saw a decade ago. And that is why we are seeing such incredible performances from the top riders at the major events in world cycling. So I sent this link to Ross, and I said to him, this looks like an interesting story. We know we've talked about carbohydrates in the past, and we know that we've talked about its role in the sport. So we decided today to kind of focus on this and look at whether or not this story is suddenly a massive change, what the research and the science around carbohydrate intake in endurance sports is about, and kind of just have a broad look at it, because there is so many different facets to where this is going. So Ross, first up, when I sent you this, I think your first reaction was, this is not really new news, even though Outside Online were were sort of selling it as something that was a revolutionary change in the way that cyclists were fueling themselves.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, like, I'd seen the article, and the first thing I did when I opened is I looked at the date, and I was surprised to see that it was 30th of November of October 2023. Because, yeah, I think what it does is this whole thing highlights the disconnect between what's probably happening in practice in elite sport and how slowly the wheels in science tend to move to catch up to it. And they never catch up to it, actually. I'm pretty sure that by now something's happening in elite sport that will only be known in 5-10 years in the scientific literature. The reason I say that is because this idea that 60 grams per hour of carbs, and I think the article talks about that, right? It talks about how, like, that was the classic thinking.
Yeah.
That was the classic thinking like 10, 15 years ago. And already 10 years ago, I think people had recognized that you could get away with much, much, much more than what had been published in the scientific literature. In fact, this is what's even more weird about it, is that it had been published in the scientific literature. 2004, there was an article came out of the University of Birmingham, and it was the first study that I'm aware of that showed that if you combined carbs, so you didn't just have glucose, but you had glucose and fructose, you could get your carb oxidation rates or your carb burning rates well above 60 grams an hour. In that particular one, I think it was like 25 to 30% higher, you know, so that was 2004, coming up 20 years. And then by 2008, Asker Jurkendrup, who we'll talk about a little bit more in a moment, had shown that if you could increase your carb oxidation, your performance improved relative to normal, just classic glucose at 60 grams an hour. And so that's 15 years ago that that was known. And then subsequently, there have been a number of different studies that have shown the same thing. And we know that athletes have been experimenting and training with different carb mixes, different carb amounts, different carb concentrations, specifically with the objective of teaching themselves how to ingest more and more carbohydrates. And that's two generations in elite cycling and Ironman triathlons and so on. And yet now I'm reading it in 2023 as revolutionary. I don't know if I buy the timelines, you know?
I think to some extent there is this, obviously a huge amount of social media and noise around keto diets and low carb diets and all that sort of thing, which are
potentially a subject.
Yeah, there's a lot of noise in that aspect. And I guess that muddies the waters of our conversation today. So I don't want to focus too much on that. But first of all, let's the 60 grams per hour scenario. Do we know where that came from? That obviously came from some level of research, or was that, from your view, something that just kind of became a line in the sand, that that's what we that's what you can do, and now it's been challenged? So what was the initial 60 gram per hour mark? Where did that come from?
Yeah, you'd have to go back to the 1970s, I reckon. You know, they were learning back then about muscle glycogen, storage of carbs in your muscle. They were learning about liver glycogen, which is storage of the carbs in your liver tank, and how the liver was putting that into the blood, and then your blood glucose. And, you know, back then they were looking at what fails first. Is it your blood sugar or your muscle glycogen? And they were figuring out that limitations in energy supply were quite a big deal during endurance sports. So that's probably where it all began. And then logically, the thing that you would do is you'd say, well, how much can we actually give to the system? Like, how much can we feed the athlete in order to avoid these limiting failures, this depletion of blood, either muscle glycogen or liver glycogen that causes then blood sugar to drop? But they would have discovered quite quickly that if you use glucose, which is the simplest form of carbohydrates, that you exceeded a capacity beyond which there was no further benefit. And in fact, what would have happened in the studies is that they would give you 40, 50, 60 grams an hour. And sure enough, the more you take in, the more you burn, the better it is. But then at some point, actually, you stop burning it and maybe you start getting sick. Maybe you start having stomach issues and gastro problems because you just can't tolerate those large amounts. Mm. And so the first realization, I think, there would have been that there was a limitation. And it's subsequently been, well, let me not try and piece together too much of the timeline, but what is known is that in order for glucose to get into the blood, it needs to go through a transporter in the intestine. You know, the guys will always say that inside the gut is still outside the body.
Yeah.
So you can drink it, you can eat it, but until it's in the blood, it's not yet in the body.
And when you say, just describe what that transporter is.
Yeah, so it's called SGL2. It's a sodium-limited glucose transporter, and it sits on the lumen side of the intestine. So that's the sort of intestinal cavity side. And in order for glucose to cross over that intestinal wall, it has to use this transporter. So it's kind of like an access-controlled turnstile. Mm-hmm. So it goes in one direction only, and if you don't have sodium and glucose, you can't get through it. But because it's a turnstile, it's got a capacity. It can only take a certain amount before it's exceeded. And that capacity turns out to be around 60 grams an hour. And so the moment you consume more glucose than that, you can't actually get it into the blood. And so that's why it wasn't working in all those experiments, is you can give the system more and more and more and more, but it's actually just, you're actually just creating a traffic jam on the outside. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes.
It's like trying to get into the Stade de France on a World Cup final night and they've only opened two gates. It's like you're standing in a queue. But then what happens is, and this goes back to 2004, that first study I mentioned from Birmingham, is that if you've exceeded the capacity of that turnstile and you then add fructose, which is a different form of carbohydrates, then you can get more into the blood. And the reason is, and I'm not entirely sure how these two transporters work with one another, is that fructose doesn't use that particular turnstile. It uses another one called GLUT5. So there's actually two gates, two turnstiles. Glucose uses one, fructose uses another. And as long as the glucose one is maxed out, the fructose one can use its and then adds to the total amount that you can get into the blood. Does that make sense?
Yes. Okay.
Now, all of a sudden, with a combination of carbohydrates, you can get more into the blood than you could have done before. And that's why that first study, 2004, by Brenshans et al., found that if you mixed your carbohydrates, you could get 1.3, I think it was 30% more grams per minute oxidation than if you'd only had glucose. And that was kind of the start of it. And by 2008, they were looking at performance benefits, and they were finding the same thing when you had a mix of glucose and fructose. And I think where we are now, excuse me, is that the commercial side has caught up. And so now you've got a number of these products that do the same thing, and they provide really high volumes of carbohydrates in these mixtures that allow the athletes to get way, way, way higher than 60 grams per hour. I mean, I was looking at one paper in marathon runners where they've done 120 grams per hour. And I mean, when you're running.
Double.
Yeah, exactly. It's enormous. And that's running, right? Where it's actually maybe a little bit more complicated to get high high carb intake because you've got motility movement of the stomach and the up and down motion of running as well. Mm-hmm. But you can do that. You can do it. And this is the point, is that if you can get away with it through training, then, and when I said training, I mean training the gut, because you actually have to practice this. You can massively increase your carb oxidation, and that's been known for some time. Remember in 2000, when was the first sub 2 hour marathon gimmicky thing done? 2017, I think.
2017, yeah. First, Kipchoge's first attempt, yeah, about that, yeah.
Maybe it was announced in 17 and it was done in 18 in Monza. I've lost track of dates. Mm. But one of the pillars on which that attempt was made was Martin.
Merton, yeah, the energy drink and gel.
Yes, and the premise there was that we could get more carbs into Kipchoge and allow higher carb oxidation rates than ever before, and that was going to unlock performance. So, again, that's 7 years ago. The reason I bring it up is to say that it's 7 years ago. So whilst I think that there's definitely scientific validity in this argument, the idea that this is explaining why cyclists are going so fast now compared to 3 or 4 years for me doesn't work. But it definitely makes a difference. I just don't think the timing lines up.
Because it says, I mean, in that article on Outside Online, there's a quote from the Ineos Grenadiers nutritionist, Aitor Virabay Morales, who says there's been a massive change in energy intakes in the last 5 or 6 years. Riders are able to eat so many carbohydrates on the bike now, almost twice as much as before. That's impacting massively on performance, but also recovery and adaptations from day to day. So he's looking at the last 5 or 6 years, actually, and saying that's where the most significant change has happened. And do you think it's been driven by the fact that there is a better understanding of these mixes now compared to previous years?
Yeah, I think so. More availability. I mean, I think initially there were probably a couple. Now there's probably half a dozen. And it's funny, like you'd be surprised at how often like a sponsorship or a commercial agreement denies athletes access to products. I mean, you can imagine you know, the right sponsor, someone else has got it and you don't, and they've got an advantage. So I think that's probably part of it. And then just shared wisdom within professional sport. People move, people talk, people borrow things that work, they discard the things that don't. I do think one of the things that's probably happened is, and there's a couple studies on this, that one I mentioned earlier with 120 grams an hour in marathon runners, they found there were less, well, the markers for muscle damage were lower with high carb than with normal carb. And so then you think, well, okay, maybe carbohydrate is protective against overtraining and muscle damage. Interesting. There are other studies that show that when you do a very high volume and intensity training block, if you consume more carbs, not just during exercise, but for the other 22 hours or whatever it is a day, your markers of overtraining and fatigue are reduced. And so it's not, I think it's probably fair to say it's not just what happens on the bike, on the run, in the training session. It's also recognition that carbohydrates are probably protective against fatigue, overtraining, maybe damage, and therefore the training stimulus can be optimized better with a better carb diet. And that will have a compounding effect over time. So acute and chronic benefits, probably.
Well, what's interesting is that because there's this move towards high carbohydrate, did that suggest then that if that rule of 60 grams per hour was in place, that the body was somehow in deficit because they wanted more. In other words, why do you need to have more and more carbs? And is there potentially a limit down the line where you say, well, you know, we can't do more than 120, for instance, that's the max? Or because surely the body can only use, even if it's getting into the blood, it only has the capacity to metabolize a certain level of sugars in your blood, to the point where taking more would actually be counterproductive or not. I don't know. I mean, I'm interested to know what the theory is around eating more and ingesting more and more carbohydrate.
Yeah, that to me is the million-dollar question. I think it's the most important theoretical question as well, because if athletes were slowing down because there was a limitation in carb delivery, like a car that ran out of fuel, then the solution would be very obvious. Fill it up and off you go again. And I think there is still a paradigm that is how the body works. I don't know that it's true. I think the body is more complex than that. And if you think about performance, like, okay, I'm trying to cycle now at 340 watts in a monument. It's a 6-7 hour ride, and I'm going to have to find at some point in the last hour and a half of a monument to win Flanders or Roubaix, I'm going to have to find 330, 340 watts for prolonged periods, right?
Mm.
Can I do that with 60 grams of carbs an hour being supplied into my blood? And the answer seems to be no. Yeah. Where I think it's interesting is if you measure the carb oxidation, if it can go up in response to more carbs, then clearly there was a limit in the first place. Make sense?
For sure. Yeah.
So, and I mean, it's still sort of somewhat jumbled in my own mind, but if you think about pacing, right, and this whole, maybe listeners would know about it as like central governor model. I always talk about it as like regulation of performance. One of the things the body is definitely regulating or monitoring is energy availability. And we don't want to run out of glucose. And so if the glucose supply, specifically to the brain and to the muscle, is in any danger at all, I think we preferentially slow down so that we protect against that potential limitation ever happening. Makes sense. Kind of like a dimmer switch that like reduces the light intensity to save power.
Yeah.
I don't know if that analogy runs. In the same way that we slow down when we start getting hot, we don't wait until we've overheated. I think it's probably the same with energy availability. We slow down because we know that if we didn't, we might run out of energy.
Yeah.
And so if the supply of energy could be increased by 30, 40%, that signal to slow down would be removed. The ceiling would be raised.
Yeah, makes sense.
That would be how I would potentially look to explain that. And it's actually, you know, you mentioned ketones a little while ago there. All these things, whether it was ketones, whether it was medium chain triglycerides, whether it was fat loading, you know, like train low, compete high in carbs, they were all designed to do the same thing, which was to spare sugars during exercise. Because the thing you don't want to do is you don't want to burn carbs excessively when you are needing to perform, because then you reach that limit or that you bump up against that ceiling. So whether you were taking ketones to spare your muscle glycogen, whether you were relying on fat burning to spare your muscle glycogen, or whether you're just giving yourself more glucose because of a drink or a gel, ultimately gets you to the same point, which is I am going to move my ceiling higher so that potential limitation is no longer in sight. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. And so I think that's what it is. I mean, you could, and I'm sure studies have been done on this, should look them up. You could infuse it straight into the blood at 200 grams an hour.
Yes.
But eventually the muscle, like it's just going to be circulating and your blood sugar levels is going to be getting higher and higher and higher because you can't exercise at the intensity that's high enough because something else would limit you first.
Mm.
I mean, you'd have to be riding 600 watts for an hour to burn that much carbohydrate.
Yeah.
Not possible. Yeah.
So essentially all the different carbohydrates that we talked about, you touched on glucose and sucrose, and I mean, are there other sources of carbohydrates, and do those, other sources? I mean, things like maltodextrin and soluble starches and those sort of things. Do they all metabolize them at the same rate, or are they different in the way that they metabolize? In other words, if you're doing high intensity, does fructose work better, or are they all one and the same in terms of carbohydrate?
Yeah, so I mean, there've been various studies that have tried different mixes to look at how high you could get that oxidation rate, the carb burning rate. And the reality is that no one has found like a magic ratio either of type or amounts. And so there are some that have looked at glucose fructose, the very first studies, for instance, of that. Some have looked at glucose sucrose and fructose. Then there's maltodextrins, which are these chains of glucose that are sort of chemically linked together and so on. So there's no that I'm aware of, and maybe this is actually something I'm not aware of. Maybe now these companies have managed to develop something that can add another 10-15%, but I don't think that certainly I haven't seen evidence in the scientific literature to show that there's a magic ratio. But what you do need is you want sugars that can be absorbed in their simplest possible form eventually. So you might package them as maltodextrins and sucroses and so on in the actual sachet or gel or drink. But by the time it's in the gut, you want it to be glucose, fructose as often as possible. Mm. Because that's the thing that gets in, the glucose via its transporter, the fructose via its one. Mm. So and then all the other benefits, incidentally, on how you package it are related to its osmolality and its fluid implications in the gut. Because, and listeners will know this, if you've tried this stuff, like if you're not careful and if you're not trained to drink carbs, you will have stomach problems at these levels. Mm. Like even 60 grams an hour is really hard to tolerate when you're exercising.
Mm.
So it's the packaging, you know. So like Martin and some of the other science in sports, I think their selling proposition is that this gets the sugar into your blood without causing stomach problems. And that's what the packaging is doing more.
And just to get it clear, osmolality is the ability for that glucose to get into the blood from the gut. Would that be a fair explanation of it?
Yeah, without messing up where your water and your fluid is. Because the problem is if you've got this really sugary substance now sticking around in your intestine, it draws fluid into the gut. And that's when you start to get stomach problems, gastrointestinal and discomfort, diarrhea potentially. Nausea, bloating, vomiting. It's really not pleasant. And so, cyclists, Ironman triathletes, like if you know, for instance, you're going to race in April, you need to be spending a couple months before that actually on training rides, practicing with this high carb intake, because especially race intensity, you've got less circulation to the gut in the first place. Maybe it's compromised anyway. And then you overload it with sugar. That's a recipe for disaster. So yeah, I think the big challenge, and it's not unique to sugars, by the way, because the same when we discussed bicarbonates recently, is you got to get it into the blood first. And the stomach, the intestine blood barrier represents a real challenge. And I think the commercial innovations are how do you do it without causing down so that all that's remaining is upside.
There's some interesting, you touched on Oscar Jukendrup, who's got a very great, very good site, mysportscience.com, where he kind of goes into some of the details. And one of the interesting things, and it's kind of a bit of a segue, is that the ingestion of carbs can sometimes be done through what's called a mouth rinse. In other words, just by rinsing your mouth in a carb mix actually can benefit you. I mean, that sounds crazy, because it's not really going into your gut. So how does it get absorbed, and how does a mouth rinse give you carbohydrates? You don't absorb via your mouth, which I find
So that tells you. And in fact, you don't even need to swallow it. You just have to like have it in the mouth for a while, and it improves performance, which tells you that it's not necessarily only about delivery to the muscle. And I remember when that study came out, I was still back, and that was in my university days, and I think I was either still just finishing up my PhD or had just finished it. And I remember we looked at that study and said, well, this kind of lends support to the idea that there's a that there's a glucose sensor in the brain, and you can almost deceive it into thinking it's got glucose by rinsing the mouth with it. Because clearly that glucose, if it's not getting into the intestine, it's not getting into the blood, it's not getting to the muscles, but your brain reacts to it as if it did. And that tells you that there must be some sort of glucose sensing mechanism where you can almost deceive your body into thinking that it's abundant when it's not. Now, at some point, that would end in disaster because...
Yes, because you do need it in the end, yes.
Yeah, exactly. But it was interesting because it did support the idea of a central controlling system that relied upon a signal from the body, in this case, sensors in the mouth, maybe, as to have been, where else could have been, or placebo effect, potentially, could be that as well, and which then created the same net results or end results as actually providing the glucose. Yeah, that was really interesting. I remember those studies quite well. They made quite an impact on our thinking, mostly because they sort of, you could only explain that if there was some sort of regulation based on sensory feedback.
So that research, I mean, that comment is actually accurate. That does actually work. A mouth rinse does legitimately have an effect on performance, which I'm amazed by, to be honest with you, just because of the brain signaling something out. It's extraordinary.
And I think it was repeated, you know, and sometimes in science, you know, you can show lots of things. You can show that drinking alcohol is good for recovery, as we discovered once when we spoke to Christy Ashwand. Turns out that's probably a spurious finding. I think this one was replicated. And so, yeah, it was interesting in that regard. Again, it could just be placebo, right? Like athletes know they're supposed to drink. So therefore, when they have that sweet taste in their mouth, they improve performance. That's a pretty powerful effect. But yeah, I suspect that it probably reveals that there's a sensing mechanism that doesn't necessarily rely on it being in the muscle, but it must also be in the muscle, obviously. You know, so,
yeah. What's interesting?
I was just going to say, so like we've seen in the past, remember there was a photograph of Mathieu van der Poel's stem?
Yes.
Was it his or Paget?
I think it was van der Poel. Yeah.
And it had on it like when he was going to drink his carb mix, when he was going to take his caffeine shot, when he was going to drink fluid. And it's obviously now gotten to the point that they're prescribing this stuff in quite a lot of detail and in very high volumes. And it would be fascinating to circle back to how I started, is to know, okay, some of those guys are so young, they've only been around for a couple of years, but like when did the elite peloton or Ironman field actually start doing this? Because I guarantee you it's not in the last couple of years.
Yeah. But there seems to be, based on that comment by the Ines Grenadiers nutritionist, that there is definitely a higher level. I mean, I'm reading a tweet here from Inigo San Milan, of course, the coach of Tadej Pogacar, who actually refers to the story that we've been using as our guide for this podcast at Outside Online. He talks about the fact that 18 years ago, when I started measuring carbohydrate oxidation rates in the lab, I saw that current guidelines, which at that time were 35 to 55 grams per hour, not adequate. I started to recommend and apply 80 to 100 and even 125 grams per hour. And he talks about the fact that science, and you mentioned this right at the start, which I was surprised at, is that the athletes themselves are almost leading the science, where you always believe the science leads the athletes. So in fact, what's first happening is that people like Inigo San Milan are looking at top athletes, and the science is then following up with confirmation of that practical use of carbohydrates, which is the other way around from what I imagined it would be.
Yeah, you always got to say, who's got the incentive though, right? Who's more open to experiment because of the incentive balance? And it's always the athlete. But science moves so slowly. Like, you know, an athlete says, I want to win. I need to find 20 watts extra. If I can find those 20 watts, or if I can run 3 seconds a kilometer faster, I'm winning the next race I compete in. So let's try 5 new things all at once. The scientist says, let's try one thing at a time and let's spend 6 months on it. So in the same time that an athlete will throw 5 things to it in 1 week, a scientist will take 6 months to do one thing. It's just a slow moving world, unfortunately, sometimes, you know, and it's out of necessity because you have to be systematic about it. And I think the best athletes are the ones who are systematic but also fast moving, you know. But yeah, it's not the first time, and it won't be the last, that athletes are doing things that science hasn't yet. But again, in this instance, 2004 was the first time it was known, published, that I'm aware of. 2008, there was a performance benefit shown as a consequence of these carb mixes. So why would it have taken 10 years for it to become practice? Because I don't think it did. I think it was probably already practiced. And I think what you've got now is a lot of people claiming novelty when it's actually not all that new. That's why it would be so interesting to find a guy like, I don't know, Cavendish, or someone who's been around in the peloton for 10, 15 years, and ask them, when did they actually start training their guts? When did they actually start doing training rides at 80, 90, 100 grams an hour of carb? As opposed to what we seem to be learning now is like everyone's only just waking up. And I don't think that's the case.
Yeah.
I did find, just out of interest, I did find an article on carb mouth rinse and endurance performance. And there are at least a dozen studies that find benefits between 2 and 5%. So it's a pretty well-established finding now.
So let's wrap it up a bit and talk about in terms of recommendations. I mean, not all of us are elite athletes, but you know, I've always believed that, you know, there's certain recommendations, having worked on runner's world and bicycling for so many years, that anything under half an hour, you don't need carbohydrates. If you get anything above 90 minutes, for instance, you need to start ingesting carbohydrates. And if it goes to two and a half hours plus, then there obviously has to be a lot of carbs ingested. So just confirm with it that is the current thinking. And then maybe we can get on to after that, like, how do we get used to this process as normal day-to-day athletes in terms of upping our carbohydrate intake?
Yeah, so I agree with your sort of rule of thumb there. But it does depend a little bit on intensity as well. Like, so 30 minutes of very high intensity, you might want to think about a little bit of carbs every 10. You know, like especially when you get to an hour. So for instance, if you watch cyclocross now, mountain biking races, those guys coming through the pits every second or third lap might want to just take a little bit of carbohydrate in, even if its benefit is only on the mouth signals, not necessarily into the muscle, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But for most of us who aren't exercising at anything close to elite level of performance, we can probably get away without carbohydrates without any detrimental effect on performance, you know? You must remember
For half an hour or less.
Yeah, even up to 60 minutes. If you go out and you're doing like an easy sort of run, sort of at your half marathon pace for 60 minutes, you don't need carbs to sustain that performance. And the stimulus is so low that I don't think you probably even need carbs to prevent overtraining. If you go and you do your long run, or if you do a harder hour run, then it starts to change, right? Because the training load is higher by virtue of the volume and the intensity. Does that make sense? So for up to... Yes. For up to 60 minutes, you could probably get away with very small amounts or even just a sip every 15, 20 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
Up to 2 hours, you probably need between 30 and 60 grams per hour, particularly if you're doing lower intensity exercise. If you are an elite athlete, then it's different, right? Because remember, those guys, when those guys are cycling at 320, 360 watts, they're energy consumption is enormous. I mean, they're burning through 18 to 20 calories per minute.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to fuel that energy demand. And so for them, it changes. But for most people during exercise, 30 to 60 for up to 2 hours is more than enough. Because remember, we start normally with relatively full tanks and we have access to fuel on the go. So like, as long as you've got a little bit coming in the form of simple carbohydrates, 30 to 60 grams for up to 2 hours should get you no problems to the finish line. So that would be for a slow half marathon, easy 30K training run if you're a decent runner, that sort of thing. Make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
Once you get above 2 to 2.5 hours, then you start to get into the area where it's a little bit trickier. And you probably need between 60 and 90 grams per hour. If you're an elite athlete, you want to maybe go above 90. But you probably don't need that unless you are an elite athlete.
And so, and how practically do you work that out? In other words, if you, you have to look at your carb drink and say, right, that this carb drink has, if I mix it in the right ratios, I have to drink this much carb. It's in an hour, I need to drink this bottle or take that gel. Is that the simplest way of doing it? There's a bit of homework to be done.
Yeah, and practically what you don't want to do is try and ingest it all at once because, you know, to get, let's say it's 60 grams an hour, like, you could have a 10% solution. That would be 600 mils of a 10% solution. So first of all, that's very sweet. But if you're trained to drink it, you can get away with it. But you still need 600 mils in one go. That's not going to be comfortable.
For sure.
It becomes a practical exercise of saying, let's have 150 mils every 15 minutes. So I'll sip a cup, basically, the equivalent of a cup every 15 to 20 minutes. And that's how I'll get it in over the course of the duration. So it's a practical thing. The higher the concentration you can get away with, the better it is. But that requires a fair amount of training of your gut, you know. And there's definitely evidence that you can do that. And so you probably want to go out and say, right, I'm going to do 2 hours at close to race intensity, because that's a key point. If you practice at low intensities and then race at high intensities, guarantee you the circumstances are going to be quite different
as for sure.
How much you can tolerate. So let's say it's 2 hours at sort of race intensity. Can I take 60 an hour? Might be uncomfortable the first two times. After the third, fourth, fifth time, I start to get a little bit better. Now let's try 75 an hour, and then let's try 90 an hour. So it's a question of just like, it's exactly the same thing you do when it comes to training volume and speed. You just gradually load the system a little bit more each time.
Okay. So I mean that was it. You almost answered my question there. So I was going to ask, is there a blanket rule? And actually, what you're saying is that most of us would struggle to actually bring in and tolerate as much carbohydrate as you could. You'd need to train your gut to do that. So actually, drinking and getting used to drinking as much carbohydrate as you can is probably a fairly good way of looking at it if you're doing long endurance type exercise, whether it's cycling or running.
Yeah, if performance is your objective from that exercise, again, the kind of stuff safe to say, like that I do, and certainly that we do, like we'll ride 4 or 5 hours maybe once every few months on a Sunday morning and so on. Like we don't need to have 90 grams an hour for that at the intensity we ride. But if we were, like, it's DC now, there's a race in Cape Town called the Double Century. It's a 200K race. The winning teams do it in 5.5 hours, maybe.
Yeah.
The sort of average time is probably 7 to 7.5 hours. I'd say there, you probably want to be looking at 60 to 90 grams an hour. Certainly, if you want to win that race, you need to be looking at like well above 60 grams an hour of carb. And that means that race is in 3 weeks' time, right? So those guys better be training now with carbs, because if you're not familiarizing yourself with 60 to 90 an hour in training rides, then on race day, you're going to struggle to get that in over the course of 6 hours. I mean, think about how much sugar that is over 6 hours. That's
a lot.
540 grams worth of sugar. So you really have to practice it. But I wouldn't become obsessive about this unless you've got real performance aspirations, you know?
Because in theory, if you're doing a long endurance ride and potentially riding at a very low level, you wouldn't actually access much of your glucose anyway. You could actually almost oxidize your fat for the entire way. Right. So intensity makes a difference.
Big time. Because let's say we're riding now and we're taking a sort of nice coffee cruise around the peninsula, 130, 140K, 5 hours worth. Like we're riding at 60, 65% of maximum.
Yeah.
If you're trying to win a race like DC or any other Ironman, whatever, like you're riding 75, 80%, sometimes even over that. And that difference is enormous in terms of which fuel you're reliant on. So you're exactly right. Like you don't need to replace 60 to 90 or provide, not necessarily replace, you don't need to provide 60 to 90 grams of carbs an hour when your carb oxidation rates are low because your intensity is low. So you need to be aware of what the intensity is and the duration. But as a rule of thumb, 30 minutes nothing, 60 minutes very little, 2 hours 30 to 60 grams an hour, and then above that is where you start to get into this world of having to practice nutrition in training in order to race.
Well, there we go. It's an interesting subject, and as I mentioned right at the start of this podcast, it often gets confused with so much of this talk around people on these low carb diets. But as we've seen in much research over the last sort of couple of years, when these keto diets, still the top athletes will tell you that there is a carbs are king. There's no getting away from it. For most of us who are riding and exercising and doing endurance sport, carbs are king, and very few of us can operate unless you are training at an extremely level. You can't perform without carbs. I mean, is that a fair way to summarize?
That's exactly right. The only exception is that you could use low carbs in combination with smart training to try and get the benefit for competitions. So for instance, that's the train low, compete high. When we train without carbohydrates, we force our bodies to become better at oxidizing fat. The consequence of that is that when we then race and we can use more fats, we have a sparing effect on carbs. But what you would then do is you'd make sure you race with high carbs. So you can get a little bit clever and creative about this and say that you're going to do a block of training, low intensity work, but without carbohydrates. But then when we do our higher intensity training, we're going to provide carbs. That's pretty well known now. Louise Burke has come out with a couple of studies in race walkers. It's been done in cyclists as well now, where if you do higher intensity work without carbs, you compromise the training quality. So you have to do lower intensity training without carbs, and there might then be a knock-on benefit to your carb sparing when you then have the carbs in the race situation down the line. So you can get away with it, but you have to be very deliberate and you have to be very precise about how you manage the trade-off between carb supply and intensity. Makes sense?
Yeah.
But fundamentally, if you're looking for performance at a high intensity, you cannot get it without carbohydrates. And that's not unique or limited to in session only, acutely. That's a chronic issue where for a week or two, if you're doing a hard training block, you need to be, and I think the figure I saw was like 8.5 to 10 grams per kilogram per day. So for someone like me, that's 700-800 grams a day of carbs is what I would need in order to maximize fuel replacement in a hard training block over the course of a day. So that's a significant amount. So yeah, I think we swung the pendulum away from carbs to the detriment of performance. And I think maybe when people talk about it as a revolution, it's literally the case, because it seems like it's come full circle.
It's absolutely a great way to summarize it. Well, let us know what you think. Don't forget, you can support us on our Patreon channel. You can go to patreon.com and look for Science of Sport Podcast and become one of our Patreon members. There is always lots of discussion happening on there, and I'm sure Patreon supporters will be discussing this very topic over the next couple of days. Ross often sends out regular newsletters to our Patreon supporters, and for a very small amount, which is basically the price of a coffee in the UK. I won't say the price of a coffee in South Africa, because that's a different one altogether. But the price of a coffee in the UK, you can get yourself onto our Patreon supporters and become very involved in our community on there. And we're also available on X, or as was previously on Twitter. But let us know what your thoughts are. But for now, it's goodbye.
Follow the Science of Sport podcast at Sports SciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.